Hello, heroes. Welcome to Modifier. I'm your host, Megan Dornbrock. Hey, heroes. Just a reminder that this weekend I'm at Metatopia with the rest of the One Shot Network hosts, and next weekend many of us will be at a Catacon as well. I apologize in advance for what we're undoubtedly going to do to your Twitter feed. If you're hearing this in time, catch me on either of my Saturday panels, Hacking Games for Fun and Profit at 10 a.m., and Baking Accessibility into Your Design at 7 p.m. I'm joining some smart, talented folks for both of these, like Brandon and James from that other dumb podcast, and Elsa Henry from our first show, so it's going to be great. This week I talked to Quinn Wilson, a wonderful friend of the show and the host and GM of the Swallows of the South Exalted Actual Play podcast. He has a lot of excellent thoughts on culture modding, that is, altering, expanding, or supplying cultural information within the world that a game has already built. If that sounds like a lot, it definitely is, and we get into what we can. It may not be something you want to do with your first game, but I think it's an excellent tool to use with a group ready to invest in the narrative of a game in a campaign setting, as it helps deepen the experience. Anyway, Quinn is much better at this, so let's get to the show. Joining me this week is Quinn Wilson to talk about culture modding in games. So first, I guess, why don't I let you introduce yourself a little bit, Quinn, who you are and where people might know you from, and then we'll start to unpack what culture modding means.
Awesome. Hi, and thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yay!
I think people are most likely to know me from my podcast on the RPG Academy Network, Swallows of the South, which is an Exalted 3rd Edition actual play. But I also committed the grave sin of writing a micro-RPG about Guy Fieri called Flavortown, which has been around in some circles.
I am so glad you did that. Oh, that makes me unspeakably happy.
Yeah, well, conversations with you were most of the impetus for that game actually materializing. So
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, you definitely did not have any sort of hand in that.
Yes, if anybody wants to talk to us about our love for Guy Fieri, they can find us on Twitter later.
Please.
I've been thinking about it, actually, recently, and, like, I remember watching him on that Food Network Star show and, mm-hmm. like, genuinely rooting for him, and then I think my love for him got ironic there for a while, and I've come full circle back to, like, no, I think he's, like, just, he's living his best life. Good for him.
Yes, he is a symbol. He's a cultural symbol for a lot of things. And people like to blow out of proportion the negative aspects of what he represents.
Mm-hmm.
But there's actually some good things about Guy Fieri that people write off.
Yeah. So we'll get to the topic of the show, which sadly is not Guy Fieri. We'll have to do that another day. But is culture modding. So if you could kind of talk a little bit about what that is, like a brief little overview, if that's at all humanly possible.
Yeah, so culture modding is taking not the mechanics of a game, but instead the setting of a game, and hacking the elements of the cultures therein. I like to say that it comes in two sort of main flavors or varieties, the first of which is, I would argue, the harder one, which is modifying extant cultural systems. So if, for example, you wanted to take Star Wars and make a modification to, say, the entire culture of the Jedi Order, that would be the first type of modding. And okay. The second type of modding I call filling in the blanks or gaps on the map, which is where games or settings leave open space, which can then be filled in, but you're working in the context of sort of pre-established cultural or universal contexts, which, if I want to continue with my Star Wars example, would be generating a planet or a planetary system and then fleshing out that culture.
Okay. So how did you find yourself kind of interested in this or doing this? Where does that interest come from?
Well, I would say that it comes from two things. The first of which is I am inclined towards world building and kind of customization of my own game or play spaces in general. And the second of which is I am a huge, disgusting culture and anthropology nerd, and I can't not let that bleed into my game spaces.
Awesome. Everything else that people do in their lives should bleed into their game spaces as much as possible. I think it makes for a much richer experience.
I would agree with you. Absolutely.
How did you start doing this? Like, is there a game that you played that you were just like, this needs to be fixed. This needs help.
Well, it's interesting because I've been playing games since I was like 12. And I don't know that I've ever not done some version of culture modding if it was just sort of filling in blanks in really generic varieties.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that the first time I really, really did an intensive look at this, I was running a Dungeons & Dragons game, and I don't tend to like running D&D altogether too much. It's grown on me over time, but some weird part of me that grew up playing White Wolf games used to be like, ew, D&D, but I've gotten over myself. There's great things about D&D that I love a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to play in a sandbox in D&D that provided some things that weren't necessarily on the table with settings like the Forgotten Realms, but D&D exists in a sort of context that even if you just take the game's mechanics out of the player's handbook, there are kind of universals and set things that you have to navigate and deal with. Like, mm-hmm. if you've got clerics, that makes implications about the role of divinity in the universe or the planes, etc. So I wanted to run a game that was specifically rejecting some of the overt Western Euro fantasy trappings that a lot of D&D plays into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to go kind of whole hog in looking at what I had to work with in terms of the constraints that the framework of D&D was providing and the ways that I could leverage or shape that into different usable elements for a culture in which to set this game.
Okay. Would you consider culture modding to be much different than just coming up with your own setting?
So it depends. I think that example particularly is a pretty close example to whole cloth creating your own setting, but working within a limited set of restraints.
Okay.
But if, for example, I wanted to take the city of Baldur's Gate and instead make fundamental changes to the culture therein, that is a more direct version of mm-hmm. culture modding, or the insertion of a small city-state in somewhere in the Forgotten Realms
mm-hmm.
is also culture modding, and I've done a lot of culture modding like that as well.
Oh, okay.
Particularly, you can see examples of that in Swallows of the South. I'm taking the extant setting that Exalted has, and I'm filling in a hell of a lot of blanks. I basically whole cloth created Zhao Wei, the setting and the mm-hmm. city that the game takes place in, but a lot of it is relying on the systems of culture and the way that the world works and figuring out the way that it hooks in and ties to all of those things in a believable way.
Okay.
As opposed to whole cloth making this separate world that the game is taking place in.
Got you. So you are definitely adhering to that internal logic that already exists.
Exactly.
When you're doing this, yeah.
Which cool. is where I guess I draw the line between what is world building and what is culture modding.
Okay. That's very cool. So why is this important? Why would people want to do this, or what does it do for people who are playing?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have two answers. Would you like for me to lead with the practical one or the lofty, high-minded one?
Let's go with the high-minded one first, because I want both of them.
Okay, so I will lead than with a high-minded one, which is essentially that looking at the way that cultures work allows for us, and then kind of putting into practice the way that these things work, mm-hmm. I think allows us for a degree of building empathy and understanding for the way that other cultures work, and provides us a sort of reflexive and reflective lens by which to look at our own culture and the elements therein, mm-hmm. which changes our relationship to the world around us and the people that we might have kind of put off into different kind of cultural boxes, as it were, yeah. and shows us that there is validity to various cultural worldviews, and that our own experience is enriched by interacting with and recognizing that validity. So, by changing game worlds, we allow ourselves to better our relationship to our own world and culture, I would say. That's my high-minded answer.
I like it a lot. All right, what's the practical one?
Well, the practical one is something that people like, or some people like in games. You're going to get a variety of answers depending on what people are looking for out of a specific game. You'll get a lot more mileage from, for example, very narratively oriented groups. Mm-hmm. But there's a degree of sort of visceral relatability or verisimilitude that you are allowed if you can take and tinker with cultures. It allows for an additional level of grounding and understanding of the world in which you are working. And I will say, as a GM, tinkering with cultural systems and having a real sense for the way that those things interplay and interrelate as you make these changes, at least for me, decreases some of the cognitive load of session-to-session prep, because it feels more like the world exists in a sort of natural, understandable state wherein you can understand the way that consequences flow from things.
Oh.
So,
okay.
I put in the work ahead of time, and I find that that makes session-to-session prep easier for me, and ideally it makes the world that the characters are inhabiting more parsable, relatable, and realistic feeling for people at the table.
Yeah, I can see that. And do you find that you get, like, more engaged play?
I will say, yes, but also I have biases because I'm playing with people generally that I'm taking to the table because they have similar tastes and worldviews to myself. I haven't tried a lot of this at conventions or anything, so I will have to give you a more definitive answer to that after I run some games at a Catacon.
Hey!
Because I haven't done a whole lot of con gaming, so.
Yeah. I'd be curious to hear about how much you're able to do within that limited con space. You know, you don't have the time to kind of dig into as much as you would with a campaign of returning players.
Right, and I'm interested in that as well, especially because I am of the opinion that you can ask for a little bit of buy-in from players in terms of reading material, but handing them, you know, the big black binder of this is the culture of the game and this is the world and I need you to read up on all of this before we start playing is a really good way to disincentivize or chase people away from your table. So yeah. I prefer a slow rollout of information in ways that hopefully slowly builds this sense of a broader, more comprehensive world, which is a little more difficult to do over the course of a concentrated 4-hour play session.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Be curious to hear how that goes. What are you running at a Catacon? I think this will come out before then.
Okay, so I am going to be running a game of Exalted 3rd Edition, because that's what I've built my brand on. I will die on that hill.
Yep.
And then I'm also running a game of Flavortown, so people can suffer through my very strange tastes in game design, and also quasi-high-minded examinations of the culture of Americana.
I'm so excited.
I'm super, super excited. It's not even funny.
Speaking of high-minded, I wanted to go back to your high-minded answer just a little bit.
Okay.
I really like that. I really like the idea that crafting these cultures and modifying these cultures is going to allow us to explore our own place, kind of. But how do people do that? What are some suggestions that you could give on how to get ready to do some culture modding? Because if we have a limited understanding of our own culture and those around us, what should we be doing to kind of help us mod and help us like try new things with these cultures?
So that is a good question. And the first thing I will say, and this might not always be a fun thing to be told, but the first thing that you have to do is research, and the second thing you have to do is self-reflect. So researching the different ways that cultures and cultural systems work and manifest allows for better understandings of ways that you can look at these systems in the fictional space and modify that, and understanding hopefully some sense of the consequences that roll out from those modifications. And then self-reflection comes in looking at those and trying to look at the things in your own cultural space or cultural conception that you might be taking for granted. So recognizing places where your own ethnocentrism is kind of playing a role that is either blinding you to or biasing you against things, and trying to question where that is coming from so that you don't accidentally make modifications or leave implications in the modifications that you're making that are either... it can be problematic on a couple levels. It can either be a strange... facile interpretation of other cultures where you are assuming that things are like your culture but with funny hats on, which is not the case. Or you can dip into appropriation or exoticism because you are not being reflective or well-researched in your approach to the translation or the modification of these cultures.
Dropping the hard truths today.
Yeah.
Is this going to be hard?
It might be. I will definitely say that my strong, overwhelming social justice stances are deeply tied into my approach to culture modding. Mm-hmm. So that is just something that I cannot extricate from this. I recognize that I can't extricate it from this. And I don't know that I particularly want to. But listener be warned.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. I think we're all going to come into this with our own handful of biases that, for whatever reason, you know, feel justified. And they very well might be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. That's everybody's going to do this a little bit differently.
Absolutely.
And that's so cool. So do you have any suggestions or key points for, like, what would make a culture believable? Like, things that we should include or make sure we don't delete, I guess, when modding some of these cultures? Like, what is a good believable culture need to have?
Yeah, so this actually kind of ties back to that idea of you shouldn't just be putting in a bunch of people in funny hats or clothes and then not really making any underlying modifications and then saying, look, I've made a culture. And I think that having a concrete aesthetic or feeling for cultures that you are modding or filling in is important, but that's not necessarily what the end point or even the starting point of culture modification should be. So the two biggest things I think that are important in laying the base work for cultural modification or cultural insertion is understanding the values of the culture that you are building and the history of the culture that you are building or modifying. And history is important because people sometimes like to think about culture as a monolithic construct. And culture is both a spectrum and B, historically situated. So culture changes over time, and a culture's relationship to its own history changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you understand what are some of the core values of a culture that you're building, for example, if you look at America, a lot of its values are rooted in its early history. Freedom and individual expression are incredibly important because of the early wave of immigrants who arrived in America, and that has colored a lot of the history, but our relationship to those early settlers and the worldviews that their descendants have had have changed over time and in different contexts and through interactions with other cultures and other forces. So if you look at kind of the roots of individual expression and the ways that that has changed over time, from the import of religious freedom, sometimes in early America, to when capitalism really started burgeoning, especially industrial capitalism, the wave of conspicuous consumption, etc., of the 1920s, and the way that that reflects sort of the individualist values of America shows ways in which that can change and shift over time. So understanding core values of the cultures that you're dealing with allows you a lens by which you can view and interplay with history. Those things are not necessarily discrete, but they play into and against each other at different times.
As you're describing things to keep in mind, the values and the how they're situated in history, my thought wandered a little bit to, I've been listening to some actual plays of dialect, and I'm just kind of thinking, if this culture building or culture modding, or however, whichever way you need to do it for your particular game, if it could be approached as a game itself with your players, using tools like dialect or microscope or like the quiet year or something to kind of help you build that history?
I definitely think that it can. And I think that dialect is a really, really great example. And I'm going to explicitly skirt issues of languages interplay with culture, even though it is super, 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 super huge, because my older brother, Natai, is a sociolinguist in training and has way more useful input that he can give on that. And so I will not butcher his ideas or the ideas of sociolinguists.
Cool. No, we will steal him for a future episode.
So, dialect, I think, is really great, and I cannot for the life of me remember the name of it, but there is a LARP that is about the basis of a religious pilgrimage, and then the way that that changes over time, and I think that that is super, super useful. I've heard Alex Roberts talk about it before, and I can't remember the name of it for the life of me, and it is bugging me.
Oh, I'm going to have to ask her, because I like the sound of that a lot.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And so things like that, things like Microscope and The Quiet Year, I think that they are a useful lens, especially if you want to take a more collaborative approach to culture building, which I think can be a really, really great thing. You just want to make sure that you have sort of equal buy-in, especially if you're all going to sit down to do something in order to create that culture. But I think that those are definitely useful tools, especially if you have everyone on the same page, which I think those games are actually really good tools for getting everyone on the same page.
Yeah. And I think, too, if you run into some trouble along the way, there's no saying you can't refine your end product afterwards. You know, you don't have to keep everything that you came up with in the game, but
absolutely. I think that one of the really, really interesting things about RPGs as a medium is the specific way in which the iterative nature of the medium allows for the refining of things in ways that you don't see in other media, because that kind of gets smoothed out over drafts before they see final release, whereas it's more of an ongoing process in a lot of games.
Mm-hmm. I guess we kind of talked about pitfalls and things to avoid when creating your cultures. Did you have anything else along those lines that you would advise against people doing?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. So, really going to explicitly plant my flag here and say, please, for the love of God, especially if you are taking or being inspired by real-world cultures, do everything you can to avoid being racist or harmful in your interpretations of these cultures, which can be the essentialization of those cultures, so taking them down and making them sort of flat representations of what that culture may or may not be through your own lens.
Mm-hmm.
It can be erasure, so either smoothing out the positive elements or the flaws of a culture, or different elements of that culture, just kind of gently sweeping those under the rug, which is something that can be done, not even intentionally, but it's something that's important to be mindful of, because erasure is actively harmful. And then the exotification or appropriation of extant cultures, which can tie into that sort of erasure or essentialization aspect, where you are making a culture out. I think that in the 90s, there was a lot of White Wolf products that came out that were very, very deeply rooted in the exotification of Asian cultures.
Yeah.
Like the entire Kindred of the East line were pretty gross. And actually, 90s White Wolf had a lot of things that were just like, yuck.
And I know they're not the only ones that do, especially with the East.
Yes, I think
there's a lot of that.
Eastern culture is a great place to look if you want to look at ways that people have done taking or translating culture in a really, really weird way, especially as it relates to that sort of exotification. They are making things out to be this really, really specific, idealized version of the cultures without mind to a lot of the real elements that were present, and sometimes the flaws, and then taking small elements and then blowing them up, like martial arts being a part of like a cultural tradition, and then suddenly everyone is a martial artist, and that's just gross and nasty, and you should not do that. But then you also see sometimes this essentialization and sort of erasure and reductionism on the opposite end, where I think almost any time I have seen voodoo in games, it has been this very, very strange, essentialized version of voodoo that is based a lot on historical conceptions and this sort of historical relationship that we have with Haiti that places Haiti as being scary to American culture because it was founded as an independent slave state. They wrestled their independence from France and kicked them off of the island, basically. And that has colored a lot of, especially given the time in our culture that that happened, the perception in popular American culture of Haiti, and particularly of voodoo, where you can sometimes see in a lot of role-playing games where it's this weird black magic voodoo doll poking things full of pins. And that is not even close to an accurate representation of that religion at all. And it is harmful in so many ways. It is just as harmful, if not more harmful, than the exotified versions of cultures that you sometimes see in other spaces, because that is reinforcing or painting pictures of cultures that place them as being sort of inherently alien or violent or obsessed with death or what have you, where that's not necessarily the case at all.
Yeah.
And I will actually speak to religion as a larger thing. A big pitfall I see people fall into when they deal with cultures is they view religion as being a monolithic and separate entity from the rest of the culture. And religion is super, super, super rooted in values and history. It is a part of the cultural system. It is not a separate thing that you can just pull out and move somewhere else without things changing.
Yeah. I'm sitting here nodding on an audio medium.
And part of that has to do with our unique relationship to religion as Westerners, especially people who come from a tradition where you, like, way back, you know, not even that far back, because imperialism is still sometimes something that happens. But, you know, you sail to a new place, you say, oh, what's up, nerds? We're here now, we rule you, and here's this religion. And as long as you have this religion, like, we're kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
So religion is seen as this sort of separate, discrete thing or tool, but it's not, even when it's being used like that. What mm-hmm. it means to the people, the imperialists who come in, and the people upon whom the religion is forced, there are very, very different relationships and meanings in that religion that you get based on the specific values and history that people are bringing to that moment.
That would be an interesting thing to explore, I think, with a culture.
The sort of interplay of the introduction of new religion?
Mm-hmm.
Fun fact, that is an enormous ongoing theme in my own podcast, because there is essentially a large empire that uses that as one of its tactics of expansionism, and the players in their home culture do not have a lot of experience with this religion, and so negotiating that sort of interplay and what that means has become sort of a focal point of the story that we're telling.
Nice.
And I think that one last really big pitfall that I see people fall into is buying into the homogeneity of culture. The sort of idea that, like I said earlier, culture is a spectrum, and people mm-hmm. tend to view culture as a discrete thing. But that's ridiculous if you look at the fact that, as Americans, the culture that exists here in San Diego and the culture that exists in Dallas or New York or Miami, you see immense cultural variation there. You even see cultural variation between San Diego and LA or San Diego and San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But even at the level of those individual cities, the way that people on an individual level relate to, value, and deal with those cultural forces are all different. You will get people who buy into different elements of culture and who endorse different elements of culture to varying levels and with varying strengths. And that is part of what makes a culture vibrant and interesting. Not everyone is always going to buy into or even actively endorse or like all elements of the culture that they are a part of. You can hear elements of that in my own approach to this and the way that I have talked about elements of our culture and the way that they impact gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so to assume that everyone from a culture is sort of this cookie cutter representation of that culture or of this sort of platonic ideal of a role as it exists within that culture is very, very problematic, and I think that it can lead to things feeling very flat at the game table,
mm-hmm.
or kind of empty, like you're dealing with a lot of cardboard cutouts, because depth emerges at the interpersonal and narrative level when you see the way that people relate to and struggle with these things, because a lot of times cultural ideals and values are implicitly, if not explicitly, contradictory in different contexts.
Is there anything that you would suggest, like, in particular for people to kind of look to get some more information? Or is it just to sort of read everything you can, just be aware of everything you can, kind of?
So general awareness is really, really good. Coming from a background of anthropology, I really, really like ethnography, and I want to make some statements about what ethnography is and is not, because I sometimes hear ethnography dismissed as that's just what the anthropologist says, but there is a very, very strict and detailed way that ethnography is, like, accounted for and structured that is very much not you drop in, hang around for a minute, and then, like, leave and write up, well, this is what I saw on my trip. There's a lot of active note-taking, mm-hmm. and good ethnography is an account, more or less, as much in the people of the culture that you are observing's words as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when there are broader implications or theoretical ideas drawn from that, there's a recognition of how that is flowing out of what has been said and observed, because sometimes what people say and what people do are different, and that's one of the super interesting things about culture. But then there is a recognition of theoretical orientation in the interpretation of what's going on. So you will get a sort of blow-by-blow account of events, and then a theoretically oriented breakdown or discussion of implications, and even if you don't agree with conclusions that are drawn or theoretical frameworks which are used to analyze what was observed, ethnographies can be useful because they provide the accounts of what has happened and interactions that take place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say ethnography is super, super useful. And then reading up on sort of cultural theory that guides some of those ethnographic interpretations at the theoretical level can be super useful. I'm struggling to think about it's hard to make specific references because the arena of culture is so broad.
Yeah.
But, go ahead.
I was going to say, and I think that it's probably important that you get as many different perspectives as you can get your hands on anyway.
Absolutely. And so, in addition to reading ethnography, it can also be really useful to read things that come from the cultures that you're interested in. Like, if you're looking at real-world cultures,
mm-hmm.
looking at the real-world cultures that you're interested in can be a useful way. And looking at the products of their culture that are available to you, like literature or film, etc., can be useful, especially if you are aware of your own ethnocentric biases as you consume that media. Because when you consume things from different countries, you are not consuming it necessarily at quote-unquote face value. You are interpreting it through the lens of your interpretation of that culture's values and ideals, which may or may not be reflective of what that culture's values and ideas actually are. But consuming media and consuming history from real-world cultures that you're interested in looking at is super useful. And then I think that theory is super useful if you want to look at the way that systems interrelate and the way that you might apply modifying cultural systems within games in a sort of more genericized or vanilla sense, not to say that you'll make bland or generic cultures, but understanding the general ways in which cultural systems work via theory allows for implementation of that when you aren't trying to, say, translate the specifics of Afro-Caribbean religions into the Forgotten Realms or what have you.
Well, in there, I definitely heard that watching anime is now research, so I'm on board.
Oh, 100%.
I guess while we're talking about paying attention to these real-world cultures and really digging into that information to help guide your mods, I bet a lot of us are coming to this assuming we are tackling games that were originally built in our own culture, you know, English-speaking, kind of Western civilization types of games. But we've got a lot of games in our within our reach that were not made from our perspective. How do we keep that in mind? Like, how do we keep in mind the culture that these games originated in when we go to mod them and tinker with the cultures that they've given us to work within?
Right. And I think that that's a really interesting question, because especially if you're dealing with translated works, you don't necessarily, unless you are fluent in the original language and the cultural framework that originated the original work, you're only dealing with a sort of back-end reflection of that thing after translation. And good translators will definitely be very, very mindful of the cultural framework and background of the work that they're translating, because that's what translation is. But it's difficult sometimes to parse intent from interpretation when you don't have access to the original documentation. But there are definitely things that you can be mindful of. And when talking about stuff that comes from different cultures, I think that sometimes it's useful to look at specific examples. So if you look at D&D, which is this sort of Euro fantasy that we have in America, raised in America, and comes with sort of a set of American values attached to it that might not necessarily be super obvious, like there's a bunch of underlying capitalist frameworks that exist in D&D. If you look at the sort of gold treadmill that is incentivized by the game, etc.
Yes.
But then you can contrast that with stuff that comes from different cultures, but that are looking at the same thing. And I'll use two examples here to kind of frame that. There's Das Schwarze Auge from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that is looking at the sort of Eurocentric fantasy from a European perspective, from a German perspective. And when we read that, knowing that it's from Germany, colors our perspective and interpretation of the way that we see that world. It's not, we aren't taking that world at face value. We're taking that world as an interpretation of Euro fantasy through a German lens, but what a German lens means to us isn't necessarily what a German lens means to German people. So that's something that we might not be aware of that we are doing as we read that material. And to additionally, I think, draw something, another line that I think is maybe more obvious to a lot of people who might be consuming this media is Ryutama from Japan, which is also a sort of look at that Eurocentric fantasy from a Japanese perspective, and the differences there are a lot more obvious and glaring, quote-unquote glaring. And so I think that draws a lot more obvious attention in readers to the idea that this is an interpretation of the Eurocentric fantasy from a Japanese perspective in ways that makes that line a lot more obvious. But when you're looking at modifying the cultures that come out of those things, it's important to try to understand the context, values, and history that drive those interpretations of those cultures and of the cultures that are being presented within the context of the game worlds that these works represent. because one of the most harmful things you can do when trying to modify the cultures of those games is to, in some sort of idea or sense of quote-unquote historical accuracy or something, modify elements of the culture that are ingrained or enmeshed in the initial cultural worldview that the work comes from, because that is engaging in a form of erasure of what makes the worldview espoused by those books or those cultures within those games interesting. So I think that's something that is just, it takes a lot of research and self-awareness to really mindfully tackle those things.
Oh, for sure.
But an example that one might use is Shinobi Gami, another game that I think was translated by Kotodama Heavy Industries, same as Ryutama was. But you don't necessarily want someone from the West coming in, looking at Shinobi Gami and saying, oh, no, this isn't what ninja were actually like, and then trying to make it a game about a realistic interpretation and portrayal of ninja, because that's fundamentally missing the point. Mm-hmm. So making sure that you are in line with the sort of intent of the game is still super important when you're making modifications, I think.
Yeah. It sounds like for a lot of these games, there's definitely some merit to maybe playing it through a few times before you start to really dig into culture modding.
I would agree with that, or at least a very careful and measured reading.
Mm. Yeah. Are there games, like types of games in particular, that really benefit from this?
So, it's hard to say exactly. I think that there are certain game styles that actively benefit a lot from culture modding. Like I said before, people who approach games from a more narrative perspective as opposed to a sort of smash and grab, mechanics focused perspective are more likely to derive a lot more immersion and satisfaction from the work that goes into culture modding. But even when you're doing something like a mechanics-focused dungeon crawl, you can derive a lot of benefit from grounding the dungeon that you've made in the context of a culture that you might have created or modified so that there's an internal consistency to the narrative that is presented within the dungeon or to the challenges that are presented within the dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that if you're looking specifically at the context of modifying, you need established culture in order to modify culture. So games that have more defined cultural spaces, as well as more defined or open blank spaces, which you have to fill, I would say can benefit more from culture modding, but that is overlooking the benefit that you might derive from taking something that is set, for example, in the modern world, and following out the repercussions of trying to engage with theoretical cultural modifications of our own cultures. So, it depends, as is the answer with almost anything that relates to culture.
Yep. And gaming.
Yep.
Sorry, anybody looking for, like, hard answers. Like,
I will not commit to anything.
Yep. Except to Exalted.
Yes.
Have you done this with many other games outside of Exalted?
Like I said, I've done some stuff with D&D, and I've done some with Star Wars.
Okay.
Just playing around with system creation and planetary cultures, etc. But working within the context that is defined within what we know to be the Star Wars universe. I haven't had the time to really get in and sink my teeth into many more long-term campaigns since I got really deep into culture mods. So those are my big three. But it's something that I bring to the table oftentimes when I run with things. And actually, I will say that Flavortown is looking at American culture from a very specific way, and in that sense, I'm not taking a game setting and modifying it, but I am taking American culture, or the lens of Americana that I believe that Guy Fieri to be most representative of, and I am putting those things under a specific magnifying glass while toning down other elements. in order to make specific statements. So in a way, Flavortown is an exercise in cultural modification in a broader sense.
Cool. I'm reflecting back now on a couple games I think I've played recently where I think the folks running it were doing this without, I mean, without naming it as such, but, you know, just doing it to make games either a bit more engaging or in several cases, like less racist, which or sexist or, you know, those sorts of things, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, that's something that usually I will sort of come to the table and do straight out.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really, really upsets me about D&D, like, oh my god, it makes me furious sometimes, is default approaches to races, particularly orcs slash half-orcs and the drow,
mm-hmm.
because denying that there are very, very clear and obvious racial analogs, be they intentional or not, that exist within those races and the way that they mm-hmm. are treated to our own world is ridiculous. And it makes me feel gross and nasty. So usually one of the first things I do is specifically address issues of racism and sexism. And if those are issues that are going to be present within a game world, I get explicit buy-in from players. And usually it's still something that I don't engage with all that much because I don't like to deal with it because it sucks.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one. And there's a couple other games out there that I could recommend to you later that'll make you want to throw the book across the room that are surprisingly modern.
Oh,
so,
no.
I think that's, I don't know, I really hope that people are interested in this and kind of take the time to do this with games.
Yeah, I think that it's a super important element of sort of looking at the future of game design, where modifying cultures and playing with cultures allows you, if you want to pursue something like game design or world building in a broader sense, mm-hmm. hopefully provides you the framework to include and portray a more inclusive environment. And a more inclusive environment doesn't mean an environment without issues or a culture without problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean portraying a world which does not mindlessly or accidentally replicate or magnify issues which people actively struggle with and which they may be turning to gaming as an escape from.
Yeah, I really like the way you put that. I think that's really important. If people have heard nothing else this episode, I want them to have heard that.
Yes, please, please just be inclusive.
Everybody wants to have a good time. That's all anybody wants. So,
and the more people that play games, the more we all benefit in the realm of gaming. No one is hurt by having more varied voices at the table.
Yeah.
Just period.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to make sure we hit on as far as culture mods go?
Let me see. I will say that whenever people make or modify cultures in the sort of sense of trying not to mindlessly drag your own ethnocentric biases into games,
mm-hmm.
be mindful of power and status dynamics and the ways that those emerge and interplay, where we tend to conflate money and power, but you will still find power dynamics and power structures and this sort of interplay of cultural forces in a quote-unquote egalitarian society where there might not be a monetary system. And so parsing out some of those things can be a super useful lens. And know ultimately that when you make modifications to game cultures, that I've talked a lot about it, like it's super serious business. But it's also important to be mindful that ultimately what you're doing is playing a game. And to that end, you should look at this as something of a design element. And mindful and good design always incorporates a purpose and an end to which elements are included in a particular design. So be aware of the values in history and be aware of the way that that interplays to things like active aesthetics, but mm-hmm. also understand that what you're looking for is an engaging and parsable culture to engage with at the table, not necessarily something that would hold up if it were translated into the real world, or something that is perfectly internally consistent,
mm-hmm.
because ultimately you're looking for something that's playable if you're doing this for your game table, and playability is super important.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I've rambled at you all so much, so thank you for just letting me run my mouth.
No, I'm so glad you did. This has been great. This has been awesome.
I really enjoyed myself.
I know I've learned a lot. I hope everybody else has learned a lot.
I do have one more super duper important thing that I feel like I should say.
What?
Having said all this stuff about various cultures, if I got anything wrong, please, for the love of God, come at me and correct me. I will not fight you. I will listen.
Awesome.
I am interested in inclusive spaces. Please, for the love of God, tell me if I messed up.
Where can people come tell you that you're wrong on the internet, Quinn?
Well, people can find me at my garbage Twitter handle, at MonkeyPieQuinn. That is MonkeyPiQuinn. And you can also find my show at Swallows of South, or at its website, www.swallowsofthesouth.com. And that's more or less where you're most likely to find me. Twitter's on my phone. I check Twitter a lot. If you want to yell at me about something that I messed up, that's where you should find me.
And this episode will be out very soon. So you will be at a catacomb.
Yes, I will be at a catacomb in Dayton, Ohio from November 10th to the 14th. I get there a day early and I leave a day late.
Nice.
So if you happen to be bumming around Dayton and you want to, play games, chat me up, whatever, I will be there.
Or tell him he's wrong in person.
Yes, tell me I'm wrong in person, please.
Awesome. Any other con plans coming up?
Not in the immediate future. I might see if I can make it down to Gen Con this coming year, but I need to make sure all my finances line up, etc.
Yep. I think everyone is in that boat.
Yeah. Also, if you would like, I can throw you the link to Flavortown to throw in the show notes.
Yes.
Excellent.
Everyone needs to play Flavortown.
And you can listen to that be played in a bonus episode of Swallows of the South that was released recently. So there's that.
Awesome. I will link that too. And all of Swallows of the South. Everybody should go add that to their podcatchers. So
you can see all the stuff I've been talking about in practice, in
flawed,
imperfect practice. I'm proud of the product. I love it.
You have got some definite characters on that show. Well, thank you again.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks again to Quinn for hanging out with me so early in the morning. Time zones are rough. We kept talking after and thought you all might enjoy reading some examples of culture modding. Quinn Murphy, who has a ton of excellent writing on game design, has a reworking of the Drow that's linked in the show notes to get you started. How about some network news? Jim McClure has launched his new actual play podcast, Satanic Panic, wherein some nerds play his new game by the same name. Check out the Talking Tabletop feed for the first episode. And some not network news, another great podcast you should listen to is Whelmed, The Young Justice Files. Co-hosted by the sweetest and most positive network friend, Rich Howard, Whelmed takes a deep, thoughtful look at the Young Justice TV show and its approaches to storytelling. While not explicitly a games podcast, Rich and Caleb's discussion on narrative will have your GM wheels spinning for sure. That's it for this week, heroes. You can find Modifier on Twitter at Modifier Podcast or at the headquarters at modifierpodcast.tumblr.com. You can send comments, questions, or contribution suggestions to modifierpodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, please consider leaving a review on iTunes, as that helps more people find us. Modifier is a proud member of the One Shot Podcast Network, an amazing family of RPG podcasts that includes incredible shows like One Shot, Campaign, Backstory, and Talking Tabletop.
Modifier's theme music was created by my favorite Bothan, Kat Greenfield, whose myriad talents are on display at katgreenfield.com. Join me again in 2 weeks for another episode of Modifier. See you then!